Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Bruce Blumberg. Bruce is a professor of developmental and cell biology at the University of California, Irvine, where his lab studies gene-environment interactions. They look at how organisms develop, how embryonic development happens. They look at the genetic and epigenetic mechanisms involved in development. And they do a lot of work looking at how environmental toxins, endocrine disruptors, and obesogens, environmental chemicals, things like that, how these environmental chemicals influence development, either by disrupting the endocrine system and how our hormones are functioning, by disrupting other processes in development, and how that affects various aspects of biology. One really interesting area of research they've been working on is how environmental obesogens, chemicals that animals are exposed to, influence development in ways that increase the propensity to obesity. So they can give certain animals drinking water that has an environmental contaminant called TBT. Those animals get fatter quicker when the fat content of their diet is increased. What's interesting is so do their offspring, and so do their offspring, and their offspring, and their offspring, even though with each successive generation, they don't have that chemical in their water. So they're looking at this kind of epigenetic transgenerational mechanism whereby an environmental exposure to one chemical can cause a phenotype, in this case, a increased propensity towards obesity. How that actually takes place and how it's inherited transgenerationally through epigenetic mechanisms. So if you're interested in environmental toxins, obesogens, things that cause obesity, things like endocrine disruptors, estrogens, microplastics, pesticides. We talked about all that stuff, what we know about it, how common it is in our environment. It's actually very, very common. And how it affects the underlying biology related to things like fat metabolism, obesity, and metabolic health. Towards the end, Bruce also shared some strategies for avoiding these types of environmental toxins, avoiding obesogens that are in the water or in the food supply, how to use things like water filters, how to shop for produce to avoid exposure to pesticides and other contaminants. Just a really interesting episode all around, really interesting basic science research, really interesting applications here, obviously, in terms of how humans might get exposed to and avoid exposure to these types of things. And it ties in really nicely to obesity and metabolic health. As always, I have a Substack located at mindandmatter.substack.com. I have a link to it in the episode description. You can go there to find all of my podcast content, sign up for my free weekly newsletter to stay up to date about upcoming guests and other things that I'm working on, and access my long-form science writing. I actually have a new article up right now in a series I'm writing about the dietary influences on metabolic health and dysfunction. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form, and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure. And vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Bruce Blumberg. Can you start off by just telling everyone a little bit about who you are and what your lab does?
Well, I'm a professor of developmental cell biology, primarily at the University of California, Irvine. And I started out as a developmental biologist. I'm just trying to understand how does pattern form in the embryo? How does the embryo know to self-assemble to make, you know, a correct version of you or me or of your cat or your dog or whatever you have it? The program is inside the embryo to develop that structure. And during the process of studying that, I became interested in the role of small molecules that could activate hormone receptors on development. A great example of important molecules like that is retinoic acid. which, is a very important patterning molecule in early development. And from there, I began to look at molecules that looked like receptors, but we didn't know what the hormones were that bound to those. So we called those in those days orphan receptors. And eventually, in studying those and continuing our work in developmental biology, I realized that the intersection of identifying hormones for orphan receptors in developmental biology was the field of endocrine disruption. So that is, how do chemicals that we encounter in our diet and our environment affect the function of our endocrine system? It turns out there's quite a lot that do that. And we unexpectedly found a chemical that could make animals fat about 10 years ago, 10, 11 years ago now. And we decided to call such molecules obesogens. So we've been working on obesogenic endocrine disruptors for the most part ever since then. So for almost the past 20 years now.
I want to spend a little bit of time up front talking about some basic biology, get some concepts in people's heads. So I want to talk about hormones. So what exactly are hormones, and how are they different from just other types of signaling molecules that make our biology tick?
So classically, hormones are defined as molecules that enter the blood in one place and act at some distant place. That's the classic endocrine hormone. For instance, cortisol or estradiol or testosterone or thyroid hormone. Those are the classic endocrine hormones. And these hormones act through receptors that live in the nucleus of the cells, okay, where they act as switches to turn genes on or turn genes off. And that's distinguished from other kinds of receptors. For example, a classic example would be insulin. So insulin acts through a receptor on the cell surface that triggers a cascade of secondary signals inside the cell that eventually has an effect in the nucleus to turn genes on and turn genes off. So the nuclear hormone receptors that we work on have many less intermediates between the circulating hormone and the effects on gene expression.
And so because they're binding to these receptors in the nucleus as opposed to ones that are on the cell membrane, does that just mean that they can have a more sort of direct and fast action on changing gene expression?
A more direct effect, yes. I don't know if anyone's ever contrasted how fast the action is. I would say they're both probably so fast that the difference isn't meaningful, but it's that there are less intermediates.
Okay, so they actually get inside of cells, get inside the nucleus, act on receptors there, and so there's less in between them and changes in gene expression than there would be if we were talking about a molecule like insulin that's binding to a receptor on
Exactly.
the outer cell membrane.
Which has two or three or four intermediates. No, there's nothing wrong with having those intermediates, right? They provide a way to amplify or modulate the signal and for the pathways to interact with others. I'm just saying it's different.
I see. And is this the bit about nuclear receptors, is that baked into the definition of hormones, or are there hormones that also interact with receptors on the membrane?
Yeah, so we're getting a little complicated now. So there are the nuclear hormone receptors. These are receptors for hormones that act inside the nucleus. But to be 100% clear, some of those receptors can also find their way to the cell surface and have an action there. And some of them live in the cytoplasm and are moved to the nucleus when the hormone binds. So there's different levels of refinement, if you will, in how they work. But the general concept is these nuclear hormone receptors are a family of hormone modulated switches to turn genes on and turn genes off more or less directly.
I see. So hormones, they travel at a distance. They can act away from where they're made or where they're secreted, and they activate receptors inside of cells to switch genes on and off ultimately.
That's a fair assessment, yes.
What are some of the ways that, environmental factors can influence gene expression via hormones and hormone receptors? Can you talk about that a little bit? Maybe just give
Sure, they can
illustrative.
bind to the exact same receptors. So the one of the chemicals we work on, tributyltin, binds directly to a receptor pair that controls the development of fat cells and the function of fat cells. So it acts just like the natural hormone, perhaps not perfectly, so not with as high affinity or not as efficaciously, but they can bind to and activate or inactivate. So they interfere with the proper time and place of cellular signaling. And most of the work in the field has focused on the nuclear hormone receptors, and on those, really just a subset. So if you talk to someone from the EPA, they'll talk about estrogen, androgen, thyroid. Seems to be the only ones that they care about. But there are 48 such receptors in humans. So that's a much bigger family to be studied. So we work on a different subset of that that work on fat cells.
And so when hormones are released under natural conditions, are they typically acting on multiple tissues simultaneously? Like I often hear hormones as being molecules that orchestrate coordinated changes across different parts of the body. Is that
Exactly.
true?
So they act on any tissue that has the receptor. So if there's no receptor for the hormone, then there will be no reaction. It's really as simple as that. So any tissue in the body that expresses the receptor for a hormone will be sensitive to the action of that hormone under most circumstances.
And are they typically released into the bloodstream such that they're going to go throughout the body and therefore interact with all kinds of tissues that may or may not have those receptors?
That's the classic definition of an endocrine hormone, right? For example, that's synthesized in the pituitary and acts distantly. But hormones can also act on nearby cells. That would be, instead of endocrine, that would be paracrine, or they could act on the same cells that make the hormone. That would be autocrine signaling. So all of those are possible.
I see. So they can act at long distances, short distances, but they're secreted. They activate certain receptors, these intracellular receptors. Ultimately, they affect gene transcription. And you said that endocrine disruptors would be just any chemical that interferes with that normal hormone receptor interaction.
That's correct. And it can interfere in it can make them more active. It can inactivate them. It can activate a receptor that would normally be quiescent because the hormone's not present. But now we have an endocrine disruptor and the receptor is active when it shouldn't be. And depending when that happens during development, you can have transient effects or permanent effects.
I see. I would imagine the earlier there's an endocrine disruption in development, the more likely it is to lead to an irreversible change.
That's correct.
And how do we do so when we talk about endocrine disruptors, I would also imagine, right, as animals developing, as the animals behaving in the world, it can do certain things or not do certain things that are going to modulate its endocrine system. You can do things that might, increase the amount of a given hormone that gets secreted or something like that. How exactly do we distinguish between normal sort of natural modulations of hormone activity in the body versus endocrine disruption?
So that's an excellent question. So that raises the concept of an adverse effect. What's an adverse effect? Right? So how do we determine whether the endocrine disruptor has done something bad or has just caused a transient effect that's of no consequence? And that's a huge point of contention between toxicologists, people who study poisons basically, and endocrine scientists who study the function of the endocrine system. So to an endocrinologist, anything that disrupts the natural function of hormones and their receptors is de facto adverse. And to a toxicologist, well, show me that you made the liver weigh more, or show me that you caused this other effect, and we'll debate whether it's adverse or not. So it's a worldview type of problem. But we, for example, we take powerful endocrine disruptors all the time. The birth control pill is a great example, and it disrupts the natural function of the reproductive cycle such that you don't get pregnant. And when you stop taking the hormones, within some period of time, the function will normalize. But if a woman's already pregnant and continues to take the pills, you may cause a very serious adverse consequence on the fetus that's exposed.
What would that be? I've never heard of that.
For example, you could make a male fetus with diminished male and enhanced female characteristics. It doesn't happen in humans, but in many kinds of animals, you can totally sex reverse them. Right? You could treat frogs or fishes with an estrogen, some kind of an estrogen, and convert them all, whether they're genetically male or female, into females. So those kinds of effects can happen. So in humans, it's and in mammals, it's much more that you cause effects on secondary sexual characteristics rather than complete functional changes, like male into female or female into male. That tends not to happen in mammals, including humans, but in fishes and frogs and birds, that can happen.
And I would imagine that's just because they have different sex determination mechanisms.
It works somewhat differently. The mechanism's not totally different, but the nuances are a bit different.
And you hear a lot these days, I'm hearing more and more, at least seeing more and more about endocrine disruptors in the environment. All sorts of things. People talk about xenoestrogens, they talk about microplastics, they talk about pesticides. We're going to get into a lot of this. But is it true that how much of this is that our environment is becoming more and more filled with endocrine disruptors versus we just didn't notice as much before?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about, right? So people in my field have noticed for a long time. The government regulators tend to notice less, or they say, well, it's there, but the level's too low to worry about. So there's this concept of a threshold, right? So to a toxicologist, these poisons have a threshold of action. And as long as you're below the threshold, you're safe. The problem is they don't ever test those thresholds. Those are inferred, not they're made up numbers. They're not numbers based on biology.
How do they infer those numbers then?
Well, so the classic ways you start, you treat animals with a certain amount of a chemical, and at a high dose, it kills most or all of them. Then you look for a dose that only kills half of them. That's the lethal dose 50. Then you go down a little bit more, a little bit more, until you see what's the lowest dose at which I see some effect. And by effect, I mean things like, did I disrupt reproduction, or did I change the weight of the brain or the liver or the pancreas? Did they do really gross things? My friend Tom Zeller compares it to taking your car to a mechanic and asking him to diagnose what's wrong with it. And he takes the car apart and weighs all the parts and says to you, well, Nick, nothing's wrong with your car because the parts all weigh the same. But then you get to some low level where there's no obvious effect. So they call that the lowest observed adverse effect level. And then they start applying mathematical formulas after that and say, well, okay. This was done in a rat and it's an adult study, so we'll put a 10 times safety factor. And if it's children, maybe we'll put another 10 times safety factor. So we'll say at 100 fold below that, we'll call that the NOEL, the no observed adverse effect level. But they never tested. They just decided that
Yeah,
because there must be some threshold.
I see. So even if you assume the math is appropriate and the right scaling factors and things are used, ultimately it's based on those sort of gross anatomical defects that they observed
Usually,
initially.
yes.
And so if there was a circuit rearrangement in the brain, or there
Never
was
notice.
a more subtle change in hormone release, those things simply would not be captured.
Absolutely.
So that would I mean, the natural extrapolation of this is probably a lot of those thresholds are set up places where we are getting some kind of effect in our bodies when we're exposed to these environmental contaminants. We just don't realize it yet.
Yeah. There's two other important concepts that aren't often discussed or not discussed publicly as much as they should. The first is the concept of monotonicity. So it's actually encoded in law in the US that all responses must be monotonic. That means that the sine of the curve never changes, right? So you could say more or less linear. And the only scientists, to my knowledge, who believe that nature is linear are toxicologists. You will not find any other scientist that believes nature always responds linearly to some kind of stimulus.
So a
And I can
classic
show you.
example of this would be, I mean, most drugs have a non-linear response or an inverted U response where the dose goes up, you get more of an effect, but at some point you increase more and it actually starts going down, or you get a different effect.
Yeah, and that's absolutely normal, right? Because the living systems have adapted, evolved mechanisms to deal with excessive stimuli. So at some point when the stimulus becomes very high, the organism responds by turning off the production of new receptors, for example. So to dampen the response. Imagine, the fight or flight response. You get really, someone attacks you and you get really The adrenaline starts pumping and you get excited. Imagine if that didn't damp down after a while, what would happen to you? You would self-destruct. So the natural hormone-based systems and many other kinds of systems have regulatory components that prevents them from having runaway stimulation. So it dampens the response. So the inverted U is a big problem. It's a big point of contention between the endocrine community and the toxicological community. And what was the other point I wanted to make? I forgot my other point.
You said there was a couple concepts.
There's two.
There's monotonicity.
One is non-monotonicity. I'll keep going. It'll come to me.
Yeah, we can come back to it. Okay, so we've got all these thresholds we set because, we have to set thresholds somewhere by law if we're gonna, do anything about, things in the environment. For all the reasons that you explained, there are assumptions baked into how we set those thresholds, such mm-hmm. that the thresholds are probably above where we're actually going to see effects in the human body. And therefore, we're probably exposed to a lot of environmental contaminants that are below those thresholds set by toxicologists, but still having real biological effects on us.
That's exactly right.
Can you give us maybe a clear example of something like that where we probably are, in fact, below the threshold of exposure that's been set, but where we know in humans that there's some effect that's significant?
So let me make another point there. So that's a hard one. You said where we know in humans. The problem is that we can't and we shouldn't do these kind of experiments on humans. Right. So in animals, we can do cause and effect experiments. We can treat a population of some kind of animal with or even cells with a chemical at some dose and observe the direct effect. You can't do that with humans. And you shouldn't do that with humans. So all you can do is say, in animal experiments, I see an effect at some level of exposure, and humans are exposed to that level. Therefore, I infer that there's a risk that should be investigated.
I see. And so, even if we don't know, we can't do those experiments in humans for ethical reasons. But are there cases where, based on the animal work that's been done and based on the levels that we know certain things are found at in our environment, where mm-hmm. there would, very, very likely be effects that are happening inside of humans?
Sure. There currently is a huge battle among the regulators and the scientific community on chemicals like bisphenol A. Right. So in the US, the dose of bisphenol A that we're exposed to is allowed to be very, very high. Because it's based on studies done by industry that say, don't worry, there's nothing going on. But then the European Commission was going to lower that level of exposure 500,000 fold based on a much broader review of the literature.
And just to be clear, this is EPA? Like
EPA, FDA?
No, BP, the molecule BPA, is that what this is?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the molecule BPA, right? And it has other relatives that are equally, if not worse, problematic. So in Europe, there's a big fight now. So the European Commission wanted to lower the dose 500,000 fold, and industry screamed bloody murder. So that fight is still going on. It hasn't taken effect yet.
What industry are we talking about here?
The chemical industry, the plastics, people that make and use those chemicals.
Got it. So this is a component of plastics.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's found in, it's intended to be used in hard, clear plastics. But bisphenol A is found in lots of other kinds of plastics to give them desirable properties. So, for example, plastics are never just you take this monomer and you polymerize it and now you have a bottle, for example. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of other components in there. And there's a guy named Martin Wagner who has studied, he's taken various kinds of plastics, just extracted them with water and alcohol and asked the question, what kinds of activities do we find here? And then if we find an activity, what was the chemical? And he's found lots of chemicals that no one knew were they even there that have activities.
And how do these things normally get into our environment? Is it like a physical shearing, like little bits of plastic just get physically broken off? Do they leach into solution? All of the above?
All of the above. So the chemical, the plastics themselves are in the environment. You must be aware of the tremendous amount of plastic that just finds its way into the oceans. There's the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and there are those in every ocean, because at the middle of every big ocean is a gyre where the circulation goes around that. And if you take anything and you take a bowl and put some stuff in there and swirl it, and everything goes to the middle. And that's what's happening in the oceans. So all the plastic that's getting dumped and finds its way everywhere except being buried somewhere or burned ends up in the middle of the ocean and on islands. So that's not a good thing.
And so when we hear about like microplastics in the news and stuff, I've been hearing more about microplastics mm-hmm. in the environment. That's referring to, I would assume, things like BPA and a whole host of other plastic compounds.
Yeah, some of those are intended to be small, right? They're in face scrubs and things like that. They're there in tiny pieces, and others are breakdown products, right? For example, the vinyl floor in your house, as you walk back and forth, it gets degraded into dust. And that dust contains a lot of chemicals, most of them not good for you.
So like literally, if you're walking on a vinyl floor year after year, you've been living in a home for decades, you're breathing in bits of vinyl dust, basically.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And there are people that have actually gone to people's houses and vacuumed up that dust and asked the question, what kinds of activities do we find in here? And they find lots of activities. There's estrogenic activities. There's things that disrupt thyroid in there. There are chemicals that affect obesity in there. Of course, the question is, does that dust find its way into our bodies and cause an effect? And, you know, that's a point that needs to be discussed. I believe that it probably does, but who can do the cause and effect experiments to prove it? Mm-hmm.
I see. So it's a type of thing where someone like you, a developmental biologist, an endocrinology person, you know, based on your understanding of the biology, almost certainly, I think you would say that there's effects there. It's just we mm-hmm. can't actually prove it because we can't really do the experiments at the end of the day.
Now let's ask about the standard of proof, right? This is another great thing. So in the civil law in the U.S., you prove something by a preponderance of the evidence, right? That it's more likely than not. You know, classic, you know, slightly more than 50% in one direction. And in the criminal law, we have the principle that it's better to let 100 guilty people go free than one innocent person to be convicted. So the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. Interestingly, in the chemical law, the standard of proof is to a substantial certainty that a chemical will cause an effect in humans.
So it sounds like you're telling me that it's stricter than
it's an impossible standard to meet. Every time I talk to lawyers, I said, if your standard of proof was to a substantial certainty, how many cases are you going to win? Not very many. So the chemical law is also rigged in that way. If you just had to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, then it's a much different game. Now, luckily, in court, if you say there's a chemical release and there's effects, you only need to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that effect was caused by the exposure. But in the regulatory arena, you need to show it to us. The EPA has to show it to a substantial certainty that a chemical is likely to be harmful to humans before they can ban something. And that's really hard.
I would speculate that the reason why things are set up this way is probably because there was a lot of industry lobbying to write the mm-hmm. regulations this way.
Of course. Yeah. I can't imagine any other way that it happened.
When it comes to things like microplastics and environmental contaminants generally, when we talk about endocrine disruption, I feel like I hear a lot about estrogenic effects and xenoestrogens. I don't hear as much about androgenic effects. Are there more estrogenic effects that we know about that are actually out there? And if so, is there like a biological reason for that?
That's a good question. I think that the reason you hear more about that is it's much easier for a chemical to be an estrogen than it is for it to be an androgen. I'm a little bit on thin ice here because I'm not a chemist, but basically to make an environmental estrogen, you basically just need a ring and a hydroxyl group. And that's something that chemical can have some amount of estrogenic activity. So the estrogen receptor, I think, is more susceptible to disruption than the androgen receptor. But I think it's also partly an historical issue, right? That the first disruptors that were discovered were estrogens. And the first meetings in the field that started to study the effects of these chemicals in the environment were estrogens in the environment. Those were the meetings in the late 70s and early 80s.
So people developed tools and did experiments that were geared towards those.
Yeah, I think it's more historical.
Interesting. So one of the other things that we're going to talk about are obesogens. So endocrine disruptors that then affect things like obesity levels, adipogenesis, other aspects of metabolism. Before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about epigenetic as opposed to genetic inheritance.
Sure.
So can you provide just like a simpler basic definition here? What is epigenetic inheritance exactly?
Well, so the word epi means on top of, right? So genetic inheritance is when you change the sequence of the DNA strand from the normal sequence of that would encode a protein, for example, and you change it such that the different amino acid is put in there. That's the most simple definition. Epigenetics affects whether genes are expressed or not. Okay, so if you imagine a tumor suppressor gene and you mutate it such that the protein is non-functional and someone gets a cancer or is predisposed to get a cancer as a result. But if you have an epigenetic modification that prevents that gene from being expressed, same exact effect, no protein, but an entirely different mechanism of how you got there. And the kinds of screens that have been done for many years, so-called genome-wide association studies, looking for small changes in DNA and associating them with the presence or absence of a disease or other trait, miss the epigenetics. Now, we're starting to do studies that will capture that, but those are still somewhat primitive. We're looking mostly just at DNA methylation, which is one subset of epigenetics.
I see that. Well, that's perfect. That was going to be my next question. So what is DNA methylation and how does this tie in?
Right. So the four bases, A, C, T, and G, right? Adenine, cytosine, thymidine, guanine. Some of them can be modified, especially cytosines can be modified on the methyl position, on the 5 position. So you get 5 methyl cytosine. And adenine can actually be methylated on the 6 position. You can get 6 methyl adenine. And whether those are present or absent has some effect on the biology of the DNA strand that we're talking about. It can affect its sensitivity to being broken down by cellular enzymes. It can affect whether a gene is expressed or not expressed, depending on where it is and how many there are.
So these chemical modifications, these methyl groups that can be added or taken away, they can affect gene expression without affecting the underlying DNA nucleotide sequence.
Exactly.
And so I know that there's more to epigenetic modifications than that, but this ties into this ties into questions around like evolution and the interaction between the genes, the sequence of nucleotides that we inherit, and the environment. So like classically, if you go back and look at the history of evolutionary biology, we had Darwin's theory of natural selection, and that sort of merged with what eventually became an understanding of DNA sequences. And there was this sort of moving into the dustbin of this idea of the inheritance of acquired characteristics. So there were ideas that go back hundreds of years around, well, you can acquire a characteristic from your environment. Something can happen to an animal as it's behaving out in the world, and somehow the stuff from the outside, in essence, gets into the inside and can be transmitted to the next generation. Are there any clear examples that we know about today where you have this sort of transmission cross generally of phenotypes that were acquired from the environment?
So it's a difficult question, right? And I think we've had this battle in evolutionary biology for years. There was Darwin versus Lamarck, and then when Lysenko got involved, it kind of really trashed up the Lamarckian view. So it was kind of just forget about this. But it seems to me in history, it's that very smart people are rarely completely wrong. So it's possible, but usually there's some insight there that might be valuable. So I think the idea of Lamarck's giraffe, right, that the classic story that the giraffe is an antelope that just kept stretching to reach the highest leaves, and that was passed on, that's kind of silly. That's not going to happen. But if you do what we do, or what Mike Skinner has done, and expose an animal to a chemical, and that chemical makes the animal get fat, and it makes the children get fat, and the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, the great-great-grandchildren, that seems to me that's pretty much a Lamarckian form of inheritance if you don't mutate the DNA, which we didn't, to the best of our knowledge. So I think that there is a role for the inheritance of acquired characteristics, but it's more subtle than the giraffe stretching its neck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I definitely want to jump into some of the work that you've done there. You mentioned briefly earlier what obesogens are. Can you define one more time for people what an obesogen is, and also talk a little bit about if there are both non-food and food obesogens?
Sure. So our definition is that an obesogen is a chemical that when you expose a living organism to it, a human or an animal, that organism either gets fat or is predisposed to become fat. And a potential obesogen is a chemical that you can show in some relevant test might do the same thing. So for example, we have cell-based assays where if we treat the cells with a chemical, the stem cell will become a fat cell. And that doesn't mean that if you expose an animal to the same chemical, you'll get the same result, right? So we call that a potential obesogen. But I don't know of a single example where we have a chemical that makes a cell in culture turn into a fat cell that doesn't also make an animal fat. Probably there will turn out to be some, but I don't know of any. So obesogen makes animals fat or predisposes them to become fat. And a potential obesogen gives a positive result in an assay that shows something related to fat function. More fat cells, more functional fat cells that don't work right, for example, that store fat but don't release it, things like that.
Are there like food obesogens? So as opposed to just, let's imagine like a fatty acid molecule. We eat those, mm-hmm. we can break them apart and get energy from them. Obviously, if you eat enough of them, you eat more of them, that's going to push you towards a direction of getting fatter. Are there foods that, in addition to being sources of energy, are also obesogens, meaning they have some other signaling function that either disrupts that they act as endocrine disruptors or something like that?
Well, I won't speak 100% on his behalf, but if you talk with Rob Lustig, who's at UC San Francisco, he will tell you that most kinds of sugars are obesogens, right? That not only do they add calories, but that they disrupt the signaling system such that you store yet more fat. And a lot of that has to do with making too much insulin, although not 100%, but a lot of it has to do with aberrant insulin signaling from the consumption of too many added simple sugars, which, you know, our diet's now full of those because in the late 1970s, I think it was 1978, we had the McGovern report that said dietary fat's killing Americans. We need to get rid of dietary fat. So we started doing that. So our fat consumption has gone way down since 1978. But if you look at body weight and obesity, 1978 is an inflection point. So after that, obesity skyrocketed in the U.S. And it's because we replaced the fats in food with sugars. That's not the only reason, but that's a big reason that our sugar consumption went up drastically.
What were some of the first obesogens that you started working with in your lab?
Well, the one that we discovered, if you will, and that we still work on is called tributyltin. It's an interesting way we started studying tributyltin. So when I began to study endocrine disruptors and started being invited to meetings to speak about our work, there was a huge effort in Japan to study the effects of endocrine disruptors and to inform the public of the dangers of endocrine disruptors is primarily led by a guy named Tyson Iguchi. And I started getting invited to meetings in Japan. And Tai had persuaded the Japanese government to measure the levels of 20 highly probable endocrine disruptors in every body of water in Japan, from puddles to oceans. So I have somewhere on my shelf a big fat book in Japanese with the levels of these 20 chemicals measured all across Japan. So Tai persuaded me to test the effects of these 20 chemicals on a receptor that we were studying that regulates how your body breaks down chemicals. It regulates the so-called xenobiotic response. So when your body encounters chemicals in the environment or when you take pharmaceutical drugs, your body knows to break those down. And that response is collectively called the xenobiotic response. It involves a bunch of different enzymes and transporters that, in principle, should detoxify those chemicals and get rid of them. Now, with natural chemicals, it mostly detoxifies and gets rid of them. With synthetic chemicals, there's no guarantee that processing it by that system will make it less toxic. Sometimes it makes it more toxic. So the classic example of that is a compound in cigarette smoke called benzpyrene. So benzpyrene itself isn't so bad, but it's acted on by an enzyme in the body that makes it into an epoxide, which damages DNA. So the system that nature evolved to break down the toxic chemical, in this case, made the chemical toxic. So that can happen. So we discovered when I was at the Salk Institute many years ago, this chemical, which we call the steroid and xenobiotic receptor, other people call the pregnane X receptor, that is activated by chemicals, whether they're drugs or foods or environmental chemicals, and turns on this breakdown system. And the interesting thing that we found back then was that the system works a little bit differently in humans and mice and rats and other animals. And that is that there were chemicals that could activate the rodent receptor that didn't do anything to the human receptor, or some that activated the rodent receptor that turned off the human receptor, and vice versa. So Tai said, can you test these 20 chemicals on SXR from as many species as you can get your hands on? So we started working on that. That's what got us involved in this. And one of those chemicals was tributyltin. And I remember I was at a meeting in the south of Japan, a little town called Matsuyama. And the meeting's all in Japanese, and I don't speak Japanese, so I'm trying hard to stay awake because I'm jet lagged. And a few of the talks were in English. And one of the talks, why am I forgetting his name right now? Ugh. Having a senior moment. I can't think of the professor's name, but he was from Ehime University. And he said that tributyltin could sex reverse genetically female Japanese flounder. And I said, what? So if you take this population of fish that will be 100% females, and you treated them with tributyltin when they were larvae, 30% of them would become males. So as a developmental biologist, I'm pretty interested in that. So I called back to the lab and I said, guys, can you extend the testing of TBT from just SXR and test the other all the other receptors? And we had, because I was at the Salk Institute, we had all those receptors in our inventory, if you will, because I was studying those when I was there. And we found out that it activated two receptors that we're interested in. One was called RXR, which is a partner for about seven other receptors. Stands for retinoid X receptor. So it's a kind of retinoic acid receptor, but it functions as a partner with lots of other receptors. And the other one is a receptor that has the terrible name peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma, PPAR
PPAR.
gamma, right? And that's an artifact of history, that name. These are fatty acid receptors. But because the first chemical that was shown to activate the receptor was a peroxisome proliferator, that's where it got its name. And the name's never been able to be gotten rid of.
That's the way it usually goes.
Yeah, so it activated those receptors. So we said, yeah, okay, that's interesting, but now what? Because that's not what we were working on. That was a side project for us. It was only funded by the Japanese government. And we said, well, okay, well, let's test what it does to cells in culture. Can it make these pre-fat cells into fat cells? Yeah, it did. Okay, now what? Do we continue with this or do we drop it? Right, because that's not our field. We didn't work on obesity and nobody wanted to hear that. I remember the very first time I wrote a grant about this, one of the reviewers wrote in the review, "How dare you waste our time with such a ridiculous idea that chemicals can cause obesity? Everyone knows that diet causes obesity." So it was tough to get that work funded. It took us probably 3 years to get our first grant to study that. But during that time, we built up quite a large amount of data that showed that this was worth working on. So that's how we got involved in that. Since then, that's grown to be all the work of the lab.
This molecule that you mentioned, TBT, what exactly is it? What do humans use it for?
It's used in many ways. It's used industrially in PVC plastics and all kinds of vinyl. Now, tributyltin is not there intentionally. The chemical that's used in those is mostly dibutyltin and dioctyltin. So tin molecules with two chains of four or two chains of eight. But tributyltin is there as a contaminant. Right? But the level at which it's a contaminant is way above the levels at which you need to activate the receptors. This is when we started working on it, tributyltin was the single example of a chemical that caused the function in biology at the levels at which you found it in the environment. So you find it at parts per billion, and at parts per billion, it turned cells into fat cells. Parts per billion, it made mice get fat. So that's why we became so interested in it, because this talk about a chemical causing or creating a hazard of an effect, according to scientists that work on it, and then the regular saying, yeah, but that's such a low dose, you'll never be, it's way below, the dose at which you find it is way below the dose at which we think it's going to be dangerous. So we only test chemicals at the doses at which you can find them in the environment, because if it takes 1,000 times more to cause an effect, that's not of interest to me. Someone else can work on that. I only want to work on chemicals that can have effects at the doses to which you and I are exposed.
Makes sense. So before we get into some of your really interesting experiments that I was just looking at, I want to take one step back. So obviously you're setting up the story that has to do with what obesity has to do with exposure to things in our environment. If we just look at the obesity epidemic from a bird's eye view, and we look at the spatial and temporal pattern of obesity spread over time, where it has risen faster, the types of people it's affected, which is basically everyone, and we look at, its sort of rate of change over time. When you think about sort of just in principle the different types of models that people have had out there for what could be causing this in principle, there's one school of thought that is more or less that a lot of it has to do with genetics per se, that a lot of obesity is inherited in the DNA sequence. There's other schools of thought that say, well, it's mostly just diet and exercise. It's how much you move your body and how many calories you put into your body. Yeah. And then, of course, there's a third potential piece of this puzzle, which is things like obesogens, things in the environment, which might be promoting obesity. If you just look at the general pattern of obesity spread over time, does it get you thinking a little bit more or a little bit less in one direction? Is there anything at a high level that can be ruled out?
I think the first thing to be ruled out is genetics, right? The obesity pandemic has happened too fast over too many large populations for there to have been a change in the underlying genetics. So I think genetics is out as a cause of the obesity pandemic. Are there mutations that can make people predisposed to become fat? Absolutely. Are they spreading through the population at warp speed? Not a chance. So the primary paradigm, and there are many people who vociferously and angrily defend this point of view, is that it's all about energy balance. It's a simple matter of thermodynamics, that it's the number of calories you take in minus the number of calories you burn. And if you make that balance, that you are not going to gain weight. And that model at some level, it must be true, right? You can't get fat from breathing the air. You have to incorporate more of the calories you consume into your body Right, but the question is, how does that happen? So most living organisms have a homeostatic control of appetite and satiety. Most animals don't eat, don't overeat. You won't go on safari and see very many fat animals. You don't see fat animals until you look at, our pets, and you look at the domestic animals that we feed. So something is disrupting the homeostatic control of appetite, satiety, and weight. There's another very important model called the carbohydrate insulin model that says the amount of simple carbohydrates in our diet are causing excessive stimulation of insulin, which is causing excessive storage of fat. So the carbohydrate insulin model does a pretty good job of explaining a lot of obesity because carbohydrates have gone up like crazy in our diet, but they don't do a good job of explaining the homeostatic control of weight and appetite and satiety. There's the obesogen model, and there's another kind of minor model called the redox model, the energy that says that the burning, if you will, of fuel molecules, the consumption, the metabolism of fuel molecules makes a certain amount of reactive signaling molecules that affect appetite and satiety and metabolism. And then there's obesogens. And I think we don't have enough data from epidemiology studies to say to what extent obesogens are responsible for the obesity pandemic. But what we can show pretty convincingly in animals is that if you expose, in our case, mice, to very low doses of tributyltin, that they will get fat, and so will their descendants. So that to me is the most fascinating thing. How are these effects of an environmental exposure transmitted to future generations without changing the sequence of the DNA?
So you expose mice to TBT, it promotes obesity. How much TBT are you giving them? How are you giving it to them? And exactly how obese do they get?
Exactly. We're putting it in their drinking water, right? Because that's the simplest way that people get exposed. I don't, pump it down their throat or inject it subcutaneously. We want to try and make a more realistic exposure. We're giving them 50 nanomolar, so more or less 50 parts per billion, which is around the dose at which you can find in humans. You can find that the average in some studies in human blood was 20 nanomolar. So we're only giving them 50 in the drinking water. So how much are they achieving in the blood?
And how do we think humans are ingesting this? Is it in our drinking water?
No one's measuring it, I can tell you. It's not a chemical that most water agencies measure. It's in many kinds of plastics. It's in the vinyl plastics in your home. TBT is used on some food crops. It's used as a miticide on nuts and stone fruits. So we don't know a lot about where the exposure could be coming from. We just know that it's out there. When you look in people, you find it. It's hard to measure, so not so many labs do a good job of measuring it. So that contributes to the uncertainty of to what extent are we exposed. And I'm not trying to say that tributyltin is what's making us fat. What I'm trying to say is here's an example compound which we know is in the environment. We have some idea of the level that's in the environment. We have some idea of what levels cause effect in animals, and those effects are permanent. What it does to our mice is it makes them predisposed to gain weight when we up the fat in the diet a little bit.
Okay, so
So
they're not
our
just automatically getting fatter when they are exposed to TBT, but when you s increase the fat content of their diet somewhat, now they do.
Yeah, they get a little bit fatter on a normal diet. So a normal diet, the normal mouse chow that we give them is 13% by calories fat. And at that level, if you keep them long enough, the animals whose ancestors were exposed to TBT will get a bit fatter. But if you switch them to a higher fat diet, and by high fat diet, I mean 20% of calories from fat, which is still way low fat diet. We're not giving them, 60% calories from fat, which some people do. We're giving them a relatively modest increase in fat. They get obese within a few weeks.
I see.
And when
So
we,
it
and it's only
predisposes
the
them
males.
to put on the fat, There's a sex-specific effect. It's only in males. As you said, it's quite a modest increase in the fat content. It's not like they're having they're not on like a ketogenic diet.
Yeah, from 13 to 20%. And even 20% is considered to be a low-fat diet. But compared to 13%, it's a high-fat diet. But if you keep the animals on a diet that's like 18% fat and then switch that to 40% fat, it's hard to see the difference.
What happens?
All the animals get fat really fast.
So they get fat faster due to this ancestral exposure to TBT. So there's this transgenerational effect. What happens if the mice try and lose weight?
Well, we've never tried to do that, right? We feed them ad libitum. We just put the food there and let them eat as much as they want. Surprisingly, the animals whose ancestors were exposed to TBT eat less. They don't eat more.
Huh. So they're getting fatter despite the fact that they're consuming less.
Yes.
Wow.
And how much less is, it's debatable compared to the experiments with cages of four animals, but at least you can say is they don't eat more, right? If they get 15% fatter, they didn't eat 15% more food. We can't detect any increase in the food, and it looks like a small decrease. And when we put them into metabolic cages, we didn't see any big changes in the respiratory activity. We didn't see that they were less active. We didn't see that they breathed out a different amount of CO2 than did the others.
So if you expose animals to TBT, they get fatter. If you modestly increase the fat content of their diet, the same effect is observed in their offspring, even though they are not exposed to TBT. So there's an inheritance of something. What exactly is being inherited?
So that's the $64,000 question, right? What is being inherited? So if you let's discuss how we did the experiment. So we took a pregnant mouse. We actually exposed her before she was pregnant, right? We exposed the mice, females, for a week to tribulatin. Then we took it away, put the males in the cage, left the males there for 3 days so that they could, do their business, and then took the males out and put the TBT back in the water. So those females, if we ever keep them to adulthood, if we don't usually do, they will get fat. But the offspring, so the offspring of those females, so in genetic terms, let's call those females F0, the filial generation. So then the offspring are the F1, and the males get fat, the females don't when we switch the diet. If we breed the animals, and not the ones that got fat, breed them before they get fat, breed their siblings, to make the F2 generation, same thing happens, the males get fat, the females don't. And we've gone out as far as the F4 generation, so the great-great-grandchildren of the exposed animal. So you can imagine, if you think about how it works in mammals, right? So the fetus is inside the mother. So the F1 generation was exposed directly to the chemical while it was in the mother's uterus. Mm-hmm. But the F2 generation was a germ cell inside the F1. So it's exposed also. So when exposing a pregnant female experiment, the F0, the F1, and the F2 generations are all exposed to the chemical in some way.
And if it's specific to males, I imagine there's some kind of specific effect on the sperm.
It could be, but we don't see that.
Mm.
So it seems to be coming through both germlines.
I see.
So in a pregnant female exposure, the F3, right, the great-grandchildren is the first unexposed generation, and the F4, the great-great-grandchildren, they're not exposed. And because we treat large amounts of animals, right, when you do these experiments, we typically will treat 25 females with vehicle and 25 with TBT. So it's difficult to imagine that we caused the same mutation in every one of those animals. That would be unreasonable to think that TBT happened as a single mutation. So I can tell you, I haven't sequenced the genome of all the animals, so I can't definitively say there is no mutation, but I think the chance that there is vanishingly small.
Yeah, that makes sense. So these animals are different, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is different about them, I would imagine that they're expressing different genes more or less than they otherwise would be if they hadn't had an ancestor exposed to TBT?
Yes. So what our belief is, our model that we've been working on since we published a paper about this in 2017, is that this exposure has caused a change in the structure of the DNA in the nucleus. So the DNA in the nucleus interacts with a lot of proteins, histones and other proteins, and that combination is called chromatin. And it makes loops, small loops, big loops, and it's folded up in a pretty compact structure. But it turns out that parts of the genome always like to be near other parts, right? So if you can think of the genome as a bowl of spaghetti, but that spaghetti has an inherent structure, and there's parts that always want to be near other parts and want to be away from other parts, and that localization of these various loops, small loops, big loops, affects what genes are expressed. Mm-hmm. So what we believe is that the exposure to TBT or potential some other chemical has caused that three-dimensional structure to change, such that some genes are more expressed and some genes are less expressed. Mm-hmm. So we tested that, and we found out that when we looked at the germ cells, we're looking at the primordial germ cells, right? The before from embryos that are about 2 weeks old, we can see new loops in a particular part of the genome.
So even though we're not talking about DNA sequence changes here, the three-dimensional geometry of the genome is changing.
Yes, that's correct. And what happened is we put a new contact smack in the middle of a gene. And when we first found out this, we said, what is this gene? What does this do? And we looked at, oh, that's the gene for insulin degrading enzyme. So these animals have excessively high insulin levels, especially when you give them a higher fat diet. The insulin levels go to the moon, only in the males. So that's the paper we have under review. We're trying to, you know, satisfy the critiques of the reviewers so that they think it's worth publishing in a good journal. Mm-hmm. And we're almost there.
But so there's this epigenetic inheritance thing working here. And one of the major genes that's affected is an enzyme that degrades insulin. So the animals that are born are abnormally sensitive to insulin. The males are.
Correct.
Is there, is type 2 diabetes, is it more prevalent in males than females?
In the human population, I don't believe so. In these animals, so if we challenge them, the animals are not diabetic. Mm-hmm. Right, that's for sure. But when we challenge them with the higher fat diet, they get insulin resistant at least. So are they diabetic? It's hard to say whether they're diabetic or not, but they're highly insulin resistant, which in humans, being insulin resistant makes you type 2 diabetic. Mm-hmm. Now when we found this new contact in insulin degrading enzyme makes it be less expressed. Then we looked back into a previous experiment where we didn't look at the chromatin structure, and we saw insulin degrading enzyme is also down. And now we looked in the new experiment that we're doing, and insulin degrading enzyme is down, and that same contact is there. Hmm. Only in the males, only in the TBT group. So that's pretty persuasive that something interesting is going on there. Mm-hmm. Question is why? What made it only there? And what made it only there in males? Why doesn't it last forever? It seems to be petering out after the fourth generation.
I see. So it's not that you stopped looking after four generations. If you keep looking, the effect goes away eventually.
No, we didn't keep the animals past four generations because this is already more than a year-long experiment.
Oh, I see.
And it costs a lot of money to keep mice around.
Okay, so it could last longer than that.
It could last longer, but the contacts are starting to go away.
I see.
So that says to me that very likely, eventually, the phenotype may go away.
Yeah.
But then also keep in mind, we gave a one-time exposure to pregnant female animals. In the reality, in the human situation, we're exposed continually. So we haven't done that experiment where we just give every generation more TBT, which would be more akin to the human situation.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow, interesting. Yeah, I wonder how that would work. Wow. So Would you say that something like this is the inheritance of an acquired characteristic in the Lamarckian sense?
I think that you could make that argument. Right? So you acquire that this altered chromatin structure was acquired as a result of the TBT exposure, and it's passed on to future generations. So that's pretty much inheritance of acquired characteristics to me. Is it classic Lamarckian? No. Is it something that would reasonably be expected in, complicated animals that are responding to their environment? Yes. So Mike Skinner has wrote a very thoughtful review article on integrating Darwinian and Lamarckian inheritance, and argues that both of them are important. The inheritance of acquired characteristics is important for rapid adaptations in the population, and that the Darwinian is important for more long-lasting effect. And it turns out that he and a few other labs have shown that the area that, with respect to methylation, that there are areas where you can make hotspots. So these are areas where you have a lot of methylation changes, and that you can also cause genetic changes in those same areas. So areas where there's genetic changes attract, if you will, other epigenetic changes, and vice versa. Areas where there's epigenetic changes attract genetic changes.
Yeah, I mean, this probably gets a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion here, but you can imagine situations where you have an acquired characteristic that turns out to be adaptive for that generation, and that then would create selective pressure for, say, certain genome rearrangements to happen to put things in different places to make them more likely to happen in the future.
Another example could be, you may or may not be familiar with the work of David Barker, who was in a British, would say he was probably an epidemiologist. So he showed that in the north of England, in Wales, that a lot of people were dying in their 50s from diabetes and heart disease. And he was able to make an association between people who were dying young from diabetes and heart disease with being born small for gestational age. And the idea is that mammals, at least, and obviously he's talking about humans, but let's say mammals anyway, animals that live inside a uterus when they're developing, that they adapt to the energy environment that they're presented with, the amount of nutrients. Are they high in nutrients, low in nutrients? And that they epigenetically adapt to that. So if they're starved, basically, during development, that they will adapt such that they use calories more frugally later in life. The so-called thrifty gene, the thrifty phenotype hypothesis, that they get away with less energy consumption. But if you mismatch the adult environment with the intrauterine environment, right? So they were starved, or they had scarce nutrients when they were in utero, and you have abundant nutrients later in life, they're going to be predisposed to get fat and to
I
have
see.
metabolic disease.
So
That's the so-called, he modestly called that the Barker hypothesis.
the idea would be, if you're an embryo inside of mom's uterus, there's a famine, there's not enough food around, you're epigenetically adapting to that condition, which is your body saying, hey, we don't have a whole lot to work with. So be as frugal as you can to power the body and save as much excess calories as possible in
Yes.
case we need that later. If you then grow up in your environment that has all kinds of food, but you've got that adaptation, now you're gonna stack up lots of fat because
Exactly.
that's what you're sort of programmed to do.
And there's another study that shows that, the so-called Dutch famine study, the Dutch hunger winter. So in 1945, the Nazis cut off the food supply to Amsterdam. They just cut it off. So the people were living on whatever they could scrounge. And women who were pregnant then, in the first, I think it was the first and second trimester of pregnancy, who were able to carry to term, those kids were predisposed to obesity and metabolic disease later in life. So there's a human example. So that's not a strictly controlled cause and effect experiment, but it fits.
And so I guess the you know, when we start to think about our modern environment, obviously we're not growing up in an environment where we don't have enough calories. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite situation. So I guess the idea would be in principle that some of these obesogens could be disrupting our biology in ways that mimic somehow being depleted in calories, even
these
though
ancestral
we
ancestral adaptive systems. Yes.
I see.
And superimposed on that are the effects of the diet itself, the nature of the diet. Is it a diet rich in healthy carbohydrates and healthy fats and things like that? Or is a diet rich in, you know, simple, easily digestible, highly processed foods because that's all mom could afford or wanted to eat?
Mm.
And that's going to have its own effect. And put on top of that, these highly processed foods are full of obesogens as well, whether it's dietary obesogens like too much sugar or chemical obesogens like perfluorinated chemicals in the packaging or pesticides left over from when the food was grown. All of these things are adding on top of each other.
When you do the TBT experiments in mice where you see this transgenerational epigenetic thing going on, you said you give them a little bit more fat in their diet. You go from 13% of calories from fat to 20%, which is more, but not an incredible increase. They get fatter much quicker. I would imagine that when you look at the metabolism of those mice, the metabolism of fatty acids is somehow different. Is that the case?
We haven't looked at that, but you could imagine that something like that's going on, that they're storing more of the fat they consume than the others. We do know that when you fast the animals afterwards, at the end of the experiment, we fast the animals overnight before we do insulin sensitivity and things like that. The animals that were not exposed to TBT, whose ancestors, lose weight very fast. So a mouse will lose 10% of its body weight overnight if you fast it. The TBT animals hold on to the fat. So they gain fat much more easily, and they mobilize it much less readily, which isn't that the human dilemma, right? Really easy to get fat and hard to lose weight.
Wow, interesting. I'm guessing it's true that when we look at things that have been shown, at least in animals, to be bona fide obesogens, there's probably a lot of these things that are directly or indirectly getting into our food supply.
Absolutely. So there's about a little bit north of 50 chemicals that we know for absolutely sure. You expose an animal to them, you get a cause and effect relationship between the chemical exposure and obesity later in life. And humans are exposed to almost all of those chemicals.
And because we're seeing this kind of inheritance, which doesn't depend on DNA sequence, you know, normally when we think about genetic inheritance, inheriting our genome, we're thinking about the sequence of base pairs in the DNA. Is it better to think about inheritance as, you know, the full 3D structure of DNA, including the sequence of base pairs, but also, you know, the three-dimensional geometry, which is important for how those genes ultimately get expressed?
Sure. It's harder to study, but I think that it's important that it's not just the sequence of the genes, right? So it's the sequence of the genes, and it's the structure, the local structure of, you know, DNA and histones and nucleosomes, and it's the larger structure of loops and topologically associating domains and A compartments and B compartments. There's many levels of organization, and they're all important. But when you consider it that way, now it kind of goes against our normal reductionist way of thinking how we study things. So it makes it a more difficult problem to solve, but it makes it a more realistic problem.
Another question I have is, you know, there's many different types of fats, many different types of saturated fatty acids, many different types of unsaturated fatty acids. When you did those TBT experiments, you did the 13% versus the 20% diets. Do you have any sense for what the fatty acid profile of those diets was?
I'm no nutritionist, but my understanding is that theirs are primarily soybean oil in there.
I see. Is that you think that's true, like by default for mouse chow that people do most experiments with?
I think a lot of it, you can get defined chow. So we just finished an experiment where we treated them with either a control synthetic diet, which would be ideal for rodents, or something called the total Western diet, which is the models the 50th percentile of the US diet. And we thought this would be really good because we now have the human connection. And what I can tell you is that the total Western diet is an abysmal diet for mice. They get really fat and diabetic really fast, even the control animals. So
What are
I'm
some
sure
of
you'll
the
see a difference.
characteristics of what does that nutrient profile look like?
Ooh, do I know the whole nutrient profile? No, but it models the 50th percentile of what the National Health and Nutrition Examination study says that we eat in the US. The fat isn't terrible. It's probably up around 30% fat.
Yeah, but I wonder, I mean, if it's based out of soybean oil, is it mostly omega-6 polyunsaturated fats? Is it something else?
Yeah, most of the animal diets are based on soybean. Some of the high fat diets will they'll use lard, and that's a pretty terrible diet for a mouse to feed them lard. Actually, I could probably look and see while we're
Interesting.
talking what's in
Yeah,
that
because
diet.
I've always wondered that. And most papers, they don't actually give you a breakdown of what, even when it's looking at diet, that doesn't actually give you a nutrient breakdown of the mouse food.
Yeah, well, you have to go to the nutrition literature because the rest of us really aren't trained to interpret that
Yeah.
diet info. Here we go. So the control diet, this is called the AIN-93, the American Institute of Nutrition. So it's a totally synthetic diet. It has cystine, cornstarch, maltodextrin, sucrose, soybean oil, cellulose, mineral mix, vitamin mix, choline, and some kind of antioxidant. So soybean oil is the source of fat. The total Western diet, is this the one? I have to find the right one. Here it is. Total Western diet is cystine, cornstarch, maltodextrin, sucrose, olive oil, soybean oil, corn oil, lard, beef tallow, anhydrous milk fat, cholesterol. So it's modeled to mimic the average diet
I
in the
see.
US, if you will.
At a glance, though, it sounds like it's probably higher overall fat content, also with a different fat profile, because you've got different fat sources
Yeah,
there.
this is 34.5 kilocalories from fat
Interesting.
versus, and that's not 17, versus 10% calories from fat, kilocalories from fat. I said 13.7, I was looking at protein, so it's 10.3
Got it.
is the control diet. And
Interesting.
that is a terrible diet for mice. The mice are so sick on that diet.
Really? And can you give us just like a basic overview? In what ways are they sick?
They're fat, they're lethargic, they're get diabetic very fast. They have
Yeah.
very insulin resistant. They have sky high glucose. They have very high insulin.
Is the for the second diet you mentioned, is the sugar content higher than the control diet?
Now I have to look again. Probably yes, I'm going to say, because it's modeling our diet.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I want to dig into that after this because that's interesting. You kind of told us some stuff that you're working on, following up on that TBT obesogen work. What's going on in the lab today? What kind of questions are you pursuing in the lab right now?
So we're digging into that. So I told you there's this new contact, a new loop, if you will, smack in the middle of the insulin degrading enzyme gene. Why there and not somewhere else? Why only in males and not in females? So what's the sex dependency? There are other sites nearby that could be influenced by the binding of the androgen receptor or the estrogen receptor. PPAR gamma is in that vicinity. So what is it that directs that new contact there upon TBT exposure only in the male mice. So that's everything that we're doing is related to that. Or the other main project is what's the interaction between the obesogen exposed animals and their diet. So it's really two sides of the same coin. So one big study asks, how does this inheritance happen? What are the factors? What directs it to this position and to this sex versus to only males versus females? The other grant asks the question, well, what did we do to the somatic tissues? What did we do to the liver and the muscle and the pancreas and the brain and other tissues that make these animals predisposed to gain fat when we slightly change the fat content of the diet? There are many more questions to answer, but we're only a small group. And these days, the grant money doesn't go very far.
So, you know, when it comes to thinking about this stuff, environmental contaminants, endocrine disruptors, all of the stuff and the processed food that we're exposed to, it's really easy to be, you know, fatalistic and just sort of say like, well, there's no avoiding this stuff. You can't get away. We, you know, unless you're willing to, you know, go live in the jungle or something, which most people aren't, you know, there seems to be no escaping. So on that theme, I just want to ask you, like, I don't know, what do you do to minimize your exposure to things like endocrine disruptors, microplastics, all that stuff? Yep. Are there things that really can be done that work, or
it's a really important question, and there's a lot you can do, but you need to make the effort, right? So I say the number one most important thing you can do is clean up your food. So that is go to the store and buy food, make your meals from fresh ingredients, right? Don't buy prepackaged processed food if you want to be healthy. And, you know, big food may scream and moan about that, but the reality is you don't know what's in something you buy, except it has a long list of ingredients, but that's not even all the ingredients. Things that are so-called generally recognized as safe don't have to be listed. So you don't have any idea really what's in the packaged food. But if you go and you want to have a spaghetti, if you buy some tomatoes and you know, you buy the tomatoes and the garlic, the things you want to put in the spaghetti sauce, you know what's there because you selected those ingredients. And if you have the opportunity or the ability to make those ingredients organic, so much the better. But the main thing is whole fresh ingredients. Make your own meals and eat as little processed food as you can. And I'm fortunate that my wife is kind of old-fashioned that way. She likes to make things from scratch. And she's even more obsessed with organic things than I am. Next thing is clean up your water. Well, before clean up your water, get rid of plastic from your house to the extent that you can. Don't store your food in plastic bowls, plastic containers. Yes, it's pretty easy to, you know, keep things in plastic bags, but the less you do that, the better off you are. So grandma or great grandma in some of our cases was right. Glass, stainless steel, this is the way to store food. Plastic, get rid of it. You're better off from that. Clean up your water, right? Tap water is not, you know, it's not terrible, but you'd be better off to filter it if you can. At least you're drinking water.
And will the normal like filters that people buy at the store, will those take care of a lot of stuff?
Depends. So the Environmental Working Group has something called the Tap Water Database. So you can go to their site and you can enter your zip code where you live, and it'll tell you what things are in your tap water that you should be concerned about. And then you can ask the question, how do I get these out? So if those happen to be, you know, halogenated organic compounds, well, activated carbon is going to get those out. And if there's some other things, you might need to use reverse osmosis on your drinking water to get rid of those things. I'm kind of sensitive to water because I keep reef tanks. So you need to start out with really pure water and add just the salts that you want. You would never run a reef tank on tap water that you add salt to because there's too much other stuff you can't control. Get rid of sugary beverages from your life. The amount of added sugar in your life, try to minimize that. It's another really important one. So I stopped drinking soda for the most part years ago. I drink sparkling water most of the time. Things like that. I can list, there's a whole bunch more, but that's the essence. You can make a difference. I corresponded a lot with an author who really was obsessed about getting rid of GMOs and things in her life. And she actually moved her family to the backwoods of Maine to get away from as many industrial chemicals as she could. And they raised their own food. And, you know, we spoke a lot about an article, how does she get her drinking water clean? Because she's using well water, things like that. So how could you, if you wanted to be as extreme as you possibly could be, what would you do? I think most people wouldn't want to go to that trouble, but for her, it was important.
And when it comes to organic, like organic produce, organic food, I've heard, but I've not verified. I don't actually know myself if this is in fact true. I've heard that organic foods often get exposed to more pesticides or other pesticides that other types of produce doesn't get exposed to. And you can actually, you know, be at increased risk of exposing yourself through organic foods. Is there any truth to that?
To the best of my knowledge, no. I think that's complete nonsense that's peddled by the chemical industry. So organically grown food, if it's bona fide organic, right, we'll use less to no pesticides. We'll use only organic fertilizers. Although you got to be careful with those, right? Because if you use manure, well, what did that come from? A lot of farmers are using what they call euphemistically biosolids. You know what biosolids are? It's the solid stuff from waste treatment plants. It's been sterilized. Okay, it's not full of bacteria anymore, but how about all of the contaminants that pass through us, pass through the animals, all kinds of pharmaceutical drugs, heavy metals, all the stuff we're exposed to, it's all being concentrated in biosolids. So if it's ever possible, I'd like not to eat that kind of food, if it's possible to find out about that. But I think to say that organic food has higher pesticide levels than non-organic, I think that's a flat out lie. If you want to know, go to the Environmental Working Group's database. They have, every year they do the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. So which are the most contaminated and least contaminated fruits and vegetables? So if you don't want to go organic, at least go for the Clean 15 and avoid the Dirty Dozen. And on the Dirty Dozen are a lot of good, healthy foods that we would otherwise want to eat. Strawberries are always in the top two or three. Apples are always in the top 10. Kale is always up there. So there's a lot of foods that you would otherwise like to eat that are highly, highly contaminated. So you're better off without those or eating organic.
Well, this is great advice. Thank you. This has been interesting. We've covered a lot of fascinating and disturbing facts here. I'm really interested in this field. I think this is really cool stuff that you're doing. Is there anything that you want to reiterate or any final thoughts that you want to leave people with before we sign off?
I would say it's important not to think that we're doomed. You know, I remember my dad used to say, you know, everything gives you cancer, college boy. Why should I stop smoking? You shouldn't think that you're doomed. There's no way to avoid these chemicals. You can reduce your exposure to all sorts of chemicals. The simplest way is to clean up your food and make better choices with the kinds of beverages and fast foods and things that you eat. If you just do that, you will be on the road to being much healthier than you are. And you may know I wrote a book about this, about obesogens, and there are other books about different kinds of endocrine disruptors and other chemicals. The message is you do have control. You can make a difference in your own life by the choices that you make.
And what was the title of that book, in case people want to go look it up?
It's called The Obesogen Effect. It's published in 2018. And the whole second half of the book is about strategies you can use to make your life less full of obesogens, but mostly less full of other kinds of chemicals as well. So obesogens are just one kind of chemical. And if you get rid of all of those kinds of chemicals, you'll get rid of obesogens and endocrine disruptors at the same time. You don't need to go, well, okay, well, this is an obesogen and this is an endocrine disruptor, and which one do I choose? Well, you can choose to have neither of them and be healthier at the same time.
All right. Well, Dr. Bruce Blumberg, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Hey everyone, I want to take a minute to tell you about a really cool health monitoring device I've been using for several weeks. It's called Lumen, and it's a handheld, pocket-sized device with a sleek design. It measures CO2 levels in your breath, which allows their technology to determine the extent to which your body is burning fats versus carbohydrates. Lumen helps improve your metabolic flexibility, your body's efficiency in shifting between using fats and carbs. It improves your ability to burn fat, which decreases your hunger levels and makes your body less dependent on snacking, and it can increase your energy levels by helping you develop a high-functioning metabolism. I use this device in the morning, before bed, and after meals and workouts to track my metabolism. With just a couple weeks of use, I learned a lot about which foods were causing my body to burn mostly fat, mostly carbs, or both, as well as how long I need to fast each day to promote fat burning. Lumen is great for anyone looking to optimize their health for either weight loss or athletic performance. The easy-to-use app allows you to track your results together with what you're eating and how you're exercising, and it syncs with other devices like the Apple Watch. Click the link in the episode description to learn more and use the code MIND, M-I-N-D, in all capital letters to get $50 off your Lumen device today.